I'm afraid we're back into a rather gloomy note again. We never get any questions nowadays about flies landing on the ceiling or anything like that. Mrs. Winifred Bronston of Sidcup. Scientists and inventors devote much of their lives to reducing human employment to a minimum. That's you, Professor Heilbronn. Politicians and economists devote most of theirs to reducing human unemployment to the minimum. And here again the lady finishes up. Which side will win? What do you think is going to happen to the human race between, on the one hand, the scientists and the inventors trying to get people out of work, save people work, and politicians and economists trying to keep them busy? Professor Heilbronn?
But I don't agree that scientists and inventors do reduce human employment to a minimum. They increase human employment. You've got the enormous increase in output of all modern scientific inventions now, once they come into production. If you take what is everybody knows of today, the plastics industry, that's going to employ hundreds and thousands of people, not only in making plastics, but in all the things that will be made from them. No one can say that the mechanical loom today, looms and cotton, have a decreased human employment. Cotton output today compared with 100 years ago is thousands fold. I think the scientist and inventor increase human employment. You've had the enormous extension in population, increase in population in this country and in the world. Unemployment has not increased in proportion to the increase in the population. You've got India with its teeming millions now employed in manufacturing goods. I think that is inaccurate.
Well, the scientist is in favour of the scientist. Russell?
I think the questioner seems to me to have confused two things. What scientists and inventors do is to diminish the amount of human employment required to produce a given result. But at the same time, by doing that, they create fresh needs, and so they keep up the total of employment, which is not diminished. I think, given the infinity of potential human desires, desire will always catch up with facilitating of employment. And you see it the present day. The surplus energy which the scientists have released, we devote to killing each other. And one way or another, we shall always find an employment for that surplus energy. So that I don't think that the scientists do reduce human employment. They merely reduce the amount of work required for a given result.
Well, that's a slightly left-handed compliment, but it's very nicely put. Miss Ward?
I think there is a real problem here, though, because it's quite obvious that if you increase the machines, the capital side of industry, and you do, as we are tending to do now, produce more and more by machines, then you do need less labour, as Lord Russell has pointed out, to produce a given amount of goods. And surely, in a right ordering of society, that would mean a greater leisure for those who in the past have worked anything from 8 to 10 to 12 to 14 hours a day. In our own epoch, in the last 50 years, we have seen hours of work reduced from about 16 hours a day down to getting on for the 8-hour week. And that, I think, is one of the ways in which this lack of balance has been compensated. And the politician's problem in securing full employment, I think it's very much more a problem, not so much of the total amount of employment as of keeping it steady. In the past, we've always had these slumps and booms in which employment falls desperately. And the politician at the moment, his chief problem is to keep the amount of labour required in your labour market steady from 10-year period to 10-year period. And there isn't any contradiction there between the scientists and the politician, because the scientists can labour save our way of work, and the politicians can even it out, both in time over a period of 10 years and in shorter hours. So really they serve each other.
Good, Deb.
I think Oswald's right in saying it's a muddling question. Mm. He's pointed out one muddle. I'd like to point out another. Miss Ward skirted round it, didn't quite get at it. Surely the question of distribution. You see, she says you invent a machine, it saves labour. Now you'd expect that there'd be less work all round. What in point of fact happens is that some people work as hard as they ever did, and the rest are thrown onto the unemployed scrap heap. I just thought the object of politicians would be to ensure that what the scientists do should be made available as a benefit of to mankind by ensuring that we all of us were assured of comfort and an economic competence on 4 or 5 hours machine minding a day. Don't let's leave the politicians out of this. Then the politicians come in, don't they, to ensure that for the first time we learn something about the art of life. I mean, as things have been up to now, we've devoted 4/5 of our waking hours to get the means to make life possible. If science is any good to us, they would diminish that period, and instead of having only 1/5 left over for the art of living, to which we bring tired brains and jaded energies, the fag end of days devoted to getting the means to life possible, we should, for the first time, begin to be able to cultivate the art of living. And there I just thought the scientist and the politician and the scientist could go hand in hand. The scientist diminishing the amount of hours which you have to work. The politician ensuring that you are so educated that you can do something with the leisure that's left over to you.
This seems to be brightening into the day. All bent it up.
But the questioner presupposes that there is a conflict or a competition, let's call it, between the scientists and the politicians. The scientists round this table deny that, and I hope they're right. But in the hypothetical event of there being such a race, we are asked to spot the winner. And in the light of previous experience, I think I should spot the politicians, rather regretfully.
Well, we followed that, I think, as far as we can at this moment. I'm afraid that's the last question today. I'm sure a great many of our listeners would be very happy to know somewhere that a house can be run on the 8 hours work a week that Miss Ward, I think inadvertently, I think she was talking about 8 hours a day, referred to. All the questions that we've raised will now be referred to subcommittees for final settlement all over the world. Next question comes from Eustace Steele and W.R. Mogg of Maidenhead. I've no doubt a great many people expected this sort of question, and we'll look forward to getting to the kind of answer we get. In view of the potentialities of the atomic bomb...
Oh, dear.
Well, I never...
In view of the potentialities of the atomic bomb, what of the future for mankind? Seeing that we've got an atomic bomb now, is there any future for chaps? Who is our atomic... Professor Heilbronn, I feel you're probably the nearest to a professional expert.
This is a question in which there is bound to be enormous divergence of opinion. To me, it seems as though there is a future for mankind if mankind now likes to grasp the full understanding of what the atomic bomb means. The atomic bomb has been used, unfortunately, in war, but the disintegration of the atom has enormous potentialities for the good of mankind. There'll come a time when we won't have coal, we won't have oil, we won't have the common means of raising energy. And the breaking of the atom gives us a most wonderful vista of what man could do with these things. But man must be much more reasoned than he is today. We're too near this enormous event, I think, to calmly consider it. But if the nations, they have this warning now, and if they like to take this warning that the atomic bomb can destroy mankind, or on the other hand, the breaking of the atom has in it vast potentialities for good. I think, viewing the world as it is, that before it is too late, mankind will realize that war with the atomic bomb, meaning the destruction of mankind, will come to his senses. I hope so, anyway.
Hold on, thank you. Miss Ward?
Well, I think there's one obvious and straight answer which you can make to this question, and that is that the atomic bomb will not ever, the atomic energy, rather, will not be used for good purposes as long as there are wars. That's the first thing. If there's a war, it'll be used in war, and it will be that much more terrible in any future war, as it is more terrible now than ordinary dynamite or any ordinary explosive substance. And again, it's quite easy to say in general terms what you need to get rid of war. The only way in which you get rid of war is by having one central source of power, a world government, which controls absolutely all the war-making weapons. That's the only way we got rid of civil war inside society. Even now, we don't always. But still, I think you've got to realize that a world government is essential. Now, having said that, one's got to measure how far we are away from it. You can say, perhaps, that only three powers come into question in this matter of world government: Russia, the United States, and ourselves. And what are we three going to do about it? I think we've started myself on a wrong foot. I think the decision of America not to communicate the atom bomb is entirely wrong and mistaken. It will mean that Russia, in particular, will use all her energy now to discover those weapons, and we shall be left in a miserable and competitive and divided state. I don't know whether America will change its decision. My own feeling would be that if not, the British and the Russians should work together so at least that side of it was cooperative in the sense of pooling and not rendering ever more rigid these national divisions. Let us, for heaven's sake, get a measure of cooperation and pooling on this vital thing, because otherwise I think we're going straight to destruction.
Perhaps we could have a ray of hope from Bertrand Russell.
Well, I'm afraid not. I don't think that I have very much hope to offer. I think I agree entirely with Miss Ward that the question is essentially simple. If you had one world government with a monopoly of armed force, then the existence of the atomic bomb would be wholly to the good, because it would make rebellion against that government impossible. But so long as you have more than one government, more than one independent armed force in the world, so long the atomic bomb works for evil. Now, it seems that mankind haven't enough sense to form a world government by voluntary agreement, such as was attempted at the end of the last war. And so the only way in which a world government will come about is by one country conquering all the others. That will mean two or three centuries of oppression, but in the long run the oppression will grow less and the world will again become tolerable. That, I think, is the best hope for the world. I don't agree that that America would be well advised to tell Russia now all about the atomic bomb, because Russia, I don't think, has shown itself fate in a friendly manner with the Western powers. If Russia were to be told, it should be as the result of a bargain involving a much more cooperative attitude on their parts. And I think the only hope that I can see for civilization is that some one country should become supreme before very long.
Well, that's extremely interesting, if not what I call very hopeful. Jared?
Well, I have two comments and a bit of history. Comments first on Professor Heilbronn. On this putting an end to war, or maybe it will do so, when Nobel, I think it was, discovered dynamite, I remember Nobel said, this discovery will put an end to war, and then instituted the Nobel Peace Prize. Other comment on Miss Ward, possibility of international control. One of the scientists involved in the discovery of this thing did tell me that in 3 or 4 years' time, any group of scientifically minded young men would be able to make it in their back garage. Seems to me to make it unlikely to control it. Hence a bit of history, which I think must obviously come from not from an earthly, but a Martian historian, that says it's the year 10,000 PMI, which means post-mortem incarnatum. Runs like this, I think. On our neighboring planet, the Earth, the age of the Mesozoic reptiles was succeeded by that of the vertebrate mammals. Of these, the hominidae, although a comparatively feeble species, and so ridiculously adapted to the purposes of survival that they could only survive by covering themselves with the skins of other animals, were nevertheless enabled by virtue of their intelligence, in which pessimistic writers have seen some likeness to our own Martian intelligence, to establish a complete domination over the whole of the rest of the planet. This they use for the purpose of preying on all the other forms of life that the planet contained. So destructive were they that speedily they would have succeeded in denuding the planet of life altogether, were it not that their energies were wasted and their attention distracted by the internecine feuds upon which their quarrelsome nature led them to engage among themselves. The domination of the hominidae was finally terminated by their discovery of how to release the forces locked up in the atom, a discovery which they speedily put to the purpose of exterminating themselves altogether. I think he'd end on a note of hope, historians do. The destruction of this noxious species by virtue of their own unaided mischievousness hath always been acclaimed by Martian theologians as affording convincing evidence for the providential government of the universe.
I would like to assure listeners that the professor didn't know this question was coming, and that although he obviously has spent the whole summer learning it all. Lord Mayor, sit down.
I should have thought that the atomic bomb might have proved a blessing in the most terrible disguise if it finally demonstrated to mankind the futility of war. That demonstration would depend entirely on a very fundamental change in the human spirit, away from contention towards cooperation. And I can only say that so far, in spite of the very terrible lessons that ought to have been inculcated by this war, I see very insufficient signs of that spirit of cooperation.
Miss Ward?
Well, I just wanted to add a postscript on what Lord Russell said. First, I agree that you would buy, it's only by getting a single government for the whole world that you'd get rid of this particular threat. But I don't think we ought to suggest that that world government would necessarily be a very pleasant form of government. But the second thing is this, on the question of whether or not the atom ought to be shared. Well, I quite agree that you must make conditions, and the conditions of much greater cooperation from the Russians. But I think that one of the factors in Russia's increasing isolationism is the non-communication of the atom. And is it absolutely hopeless to believe or trust that at the end of this war, in which after all we have fought together, that some method of common action on the atom bomb is absolutely impossible? I mean, so far it hasn't even been discussed. The decision has been taken in America unilaterally not to share the secret. My own feeling is that we could perhaps make a new move by saying, under certain conditions, we will pool the atom and set up an international organization. I'm not very hopeful about that, but that's as far as one can be positive at this moment.
Lord Ventimore?
I should have thought that the question is whether the secret was shared at this moment or not. It was a very fleeting and almost an irrelevant one.
Yeah.
Because everybody, I think the scientists at least, are agreed that in any case the secret will be common property within, let's say, 5 years at most. And five little drops of time in the history of man are a very inconsiderable part of the problem.
Hartmann?
Lord Vansittart has said just what I wanted to say, that there is not the slightest use in talking about keeping a secret from Russia or from any other nation. The atomic bomb, the basis of it, is known to all scientists. And there is not the slightest doubt that if Russia wants to, she'll work it out for herself. But surely that is not the way in which we've got to regard this potentiality of the atomic bomb today. The nations have to get together, and I don't know, I'm still optimistic enough to believe that the peoples will see ultimately that the atomic bomb is not used for war.
Well, I think that rather bears out what I mean. If it's absolutely certain that all scientists can discover this secret and that the Russians will know it within 5 years, then there's absolutely no case at all for keeping the secret. It merely means that at a crucial moment in international relations, when some of the bases of the post-war world are being laid, you in fact throw out a provocation towards isolation. I don't mean that the Russians won't be isolationist anyway. We don't know. We don't know anything about Russian policy, in fact. But I think that we are making a quite unnecessary extra provocation to isolationism.
I think I draw a rather different deduction from this last part of the discussion. It's this. Miss Ward talks about the possibility of international control. But if in fact it were for scientifically minded men anywhere, it does seem to me to make international control chimerical. Now I think I draw a different deduction. Supposing you could control it, supervise factories and so on, in Russia, in America, in England, and so on. Can you do it in all the countries of the world, everywhere, especially if it can be made in factories which are making peacetime articles under cover of making this thing? What about Japan? What about Germany? And therefore, I think my deduction is that here is a new argument, a very much more forcible argument than ever before, for making the kind of peace now that doesn't leave nations sore and revengeful and humiliated.
Yeah.
And on the lookout for every conceivable opportunity to strike back.
Oh, I agree.
Yes, but that's the deduction, not international government. I mean, we are thrown back not so much on political things, but upon what we used to call a moral change of heart, because nothing else any good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How much of that signs of change of heart can one discern at present?
None.
And that's what I think, too. And if I may, I would like to say I think we're wandering a little way from the question itself, which runs, in view of the potentialities of the atomic bomb, what of the future of mankind? The expression of the future of mankind is a very long-range policy. And from that point of view, from the point of view of long range, it seems to be immaterial whether the secret is shared in 1 year, 2 years, or five, or whatever it is. We are taking a much longer view, surely, the questioners are, I think, than we began to take for them at that moment of divergence.
Russell?
I want to take issue rather on this question of a change of heart. I don't think there's anything in that, because changes of heart are never universal, and those who don't suffer the change of heart get an immense differential advantage through the fact that the others do. And so I don't think that's the way in which the thing is going to happen. I think the thing is going to happen through any good that can happen to mankind is going to happen through a natural development of power politics, through some one nation becoming all-powerful. The question is whether that can be done without having such an appalling war first that civilization is wiped out in the process. If it can, then I think the atomic bomb will ultimately be a basis for a secure peace, and the world can gradually build itself up again. If not, not. I think it will be possible to control the manufacture of the atomic bomb. I think we must expect that in future all competent physicists will be state prisoners from the moment that they become adults.
Well, I think there's a very obvious change of heart. What we mean by a change of heart, surely, is whether we shall mean in the future what we have said in the past and did not mean. We did, after all, in the interwar period, conclude the so-called Kellogg Pact, where everybody agreed to abandon war as an instrument of national policy. Everybody signed that, and a great number of the signatories obviously didn't mean it. Now, I don't see that it's impossible that people should undergo that change of heart. I think it is possible, but all I do say is that at present I don't see sufficient symptoms of the change on the horizon.
I think that is the longest question, the longest answer to a question that we've ever had on the Brain Trust, and I hope that I've judged the interest of it from the listener's point of view accurately. Normally it's left to a question master tidy up a question, perhaps leave it on a cheerful note. The only possible aspect of the atomic bomb that I can see from the future of humanity is that it may be possible to keep warm by its help in the years ahead. And that's the only little ray of sunshine that I can find in the discussions.